Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Cal Guerin of Ready Robotics coming to us from Columbus, Ohio. How's your day going, Cal?
It's going great, and thank you so much for having me.
I really appreciate it. What you're doing is really interesting. I love the diversity. I had another interview earlier this morning with a company making antiperspirant lotion, and they just raised a round, and now we're going to robots as a service. So that's what's fun about this type of stuff.
That sounds amazing and also very different.
Cool. Well, robots as a service, I've already kind of given it away a little bit, but tell us, what is Ready Robots and where did you come up with this? What's the backstory of this company?
Sure. So Ready Robotics is, we're a venture-backed startup that focuses mainly on how to make robotic automation easier for small manufacturers, right? So small manufacturers are this interesting cross-section of the manufacturing market. They consist of the bulk of manufacturing done in the United States. About 98% of manufacturers are small manufacturers. But they're also not really able to leverage a lot of the automation that's been out there, specifically the robotic automation, because it's been relegated to larger companies, right? And the reason for that is when a larger company looked at automating a process, they would basically say, okay, we're going to take this process and we're going to automate the whole thing. And it's going to be very expensive. It's going to take a lot of time. It requires a lot of very specific knowledge in order to do that properly. And so a small manufacturer looks at their own processes and goes, well, we can't do that. We don't have the money. It's not big enough. We're not making enough of something, right? Even though they may be making tens of thousands of parts, they still look at that and they see that barrier there. So what we do at Ready Robotics is we build software, like a very easy to use piece of software that makes training and teaching these robots, these industrial manipulators, very, very easy, significantly easier than the typical way that they would be programmed, where you're basically writing code. You basically have to be a programmer to do that. With our software, it's a graphical user interface that's this very simple flowchart-based building block kind of thing that makes it, you know, I could teach you how to use this in 5 minutes, right? And I could teach you everything there is to know about it in about 2 hours. Right, which means that to get a factory up and running with robots so that they can themselves deploy these robots and solve their own problems, it becomes like a half day kind of thing, rather than with a traditional industrial robot company, you're looking at weeks of training to be able to have that same type of capability. The other product that we look at is basically a plug and play architecture, right? So when we think of our, you know, our computer, we've got USB ports on the side, you plug in a mouse, it magically works, right? Well, 40 years ago, that wasn't the case, right? If you wanted a peripheral to work with your computer, you would have to write a bunch of software for it and then write a bunch of firmware drivers and plug all this stuff together. And then you might actually have to build the physical interface that allows the mouse to connect to the computer, right? Well, now we have USB and it all is done magically, right? That's the same type of thing that we're doing with industrial robots. There's a huge world of grippers and sensors and tooling that actually allow these industrial manipulators to do their job, right? Otherwise, you just have an arm that's moving around. Well, I can't grab anything, you can't see anything, et cetera, right? So we're building this plug-and-play architecture that makes that type of integrating those peripherals, like a gripper, that type of plug-and-play experience similar to USB, where you plug it in, it's a standardized interface, a couple of clicks on the screen, and you're now using that tool for that robot.
Really interesting. Yeah. This is a bit of a tangent, but I was cleaning out the garage and I dug up a couple of my old laptops, like my old Dell laptop from 15 years ago. And it's amazing how many ports are on even just a laptop from 15 years ago. And I don't even remember what they all do anymore. Like a few were monitors or a few were, you know, like it had to have 12 to 15 different ports on a Dell laptop from 15 years ago, you know? So it's interesting. Your choice of the USB is kind of the metaphor for how you're doing this. Yeah. Really? So what were you doing? Were you working in robotics before this, or how did you come to this epiphany that led to the business?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been in the robotics industry for about 10 years. A fairly diverse history. I've worked on robotic system design for travel interstellar space. I've worked on mining robots. I've designed for surgical robots that operate in the human body, both at Carnegie Mellon and then doing my PhD at Johns Hopkins. But across all of those different systems, I was really interested in the aspect of usability, right? Because building something that goes into a mine or going into space, eventually, like there's mechanical problems that have to be solved, but then they get solved. And then you still have to have a person operate these things. They're insanely complex to operate. And so I was interested in the sort of the idea that when a person is working with these robots, you basically have this collaboration that's going on, right? The person has an idea in his head what he wants the robot to do. Right. If just as if he was there. Right. If it's a lunar robot, he would be walking around the moon and he wants to pick up that rock. And so he knows that the robot needs to pick up that rock, et cetera. Right. He has a mental model of what he wants to do. And he sort of needs to get that as efficiently into the robot as possible so that the robot can do it for him. Right. By proxy. So I was thinking very deeply about that while I was at Hopkins, and we had the opportunity to work with a local manufacturer in Baltimore named Marlin Steel. And Marlin really catalyzed for me the application of what I had been working on to the industrial manufacturing space. Because a lot of robotics is fairly far out in terms of like how usable the technology that's in academia is directly in industry, right? Mm-hmm. But in the industrial manufacturing space, we have a lot of solved stuff, right? You have fairly heavy parts that are fairly rigid. They don't move around. So from a robot, sort of a classical robotic sense, things are straightforward, right? But you have that same issue that you've got a worker that's been working at one of these factories. They're hugely skilled. They have 30 years of domain experience in working on whatever they're working on, right? They have a huge amount of knowledge. They're probably overworked, and that same company is probably having really hard time finding more staff to be able to help that person, right? So here's a guy who's doing this, but he uses a feature phone typically, mm-hmm. right? Like, so you're not talking about a very technically savvy person, but he has an insane knowledge of the processes that he works on. And can do incredible things, right? So how do you take him as this very valuable asset and multiplex him, right? Leverage him better than you currently are, because typically what will happen is you'll have a machinist or something like that. They'll be working, and they'll set up a machine, which is an insanely complex process that only he really knows how to do well. And he'll do that, and then he'll go and stand in front of another machine punching out pieces of metal all day long, right? A very, mundane task that requires absolutely no skill, right? But still has to be done well. And so that's where the fact that you can't find good labor for those tasks comes into play, right? So that's why that guy is standing there doing that. So the goal with our sort of system was, and what eventually came out is, if you have that guy who's been there for 30 years, how do you get what's in his head into a robot, into an industrial robot that can help him do the mundane stuff, right? That so he can go and focus on the very highly skilled domain specific stuff that he is so good at, mm-hmm. while letting the robot sort of do the junk tasks, right? That don't really require a lot of skill. They just require a person to be there. Right. So now you have a robot that is helping out this individual. He's much more valuable and is providing greater value because, you've turned him into five of him, mm-hmm. Because you now have these robotic systems that are helping. Right. And that was something that we could do immediately with the research that I had done at Hopkins. So that's sort of how we got to Ready, is we looked at that. We did, some initial work sort of in academia. We ended up spinning out Ready Robotics to from Hopkins, licensing a bunch of technology. We have a bunch of patents on this stuff, et cetera. I ended up stealing away Ben Gibbs, who's the co-founder and CEO of Ready, who was working in the technology transfer group at Hopkins, who was very interested in sort of the technology side and the patents and sort of the business aspects of this. So him and I sort of pulled the company out of Hopkins, licensed everything, and then got running basically June 1 of 2016 is when we really started in earnest.
And are the I want to get into the fundraising because that is the topic of this, but are the robots themselves, this probably isn't the right term, but are they kind of off-the-shelf robots and your stuff is the software and the user interface, or how's that work?
That's exactly right. And the reason why we chose off-the-shelf robots is because I always joke and say that the hardest thing about starting a robot company is building a robot. So don't. Right, because there's a lot of companies out there that build amazing hardware that specialize in it. There's, you know, billion-dollar robot companies that build amazing things. Like, I don't need to reinvent the wheel. There's already a lot of really good hardware out there. But what's missing is the glue that lets you plug all of these different robots into the different peripherals that they need to do real work, and then the software that wraps it all together.
Yeah, And just from the business model, are you buying the robots, layering on your middleware, your glue, your software, and then, you know, as a service typically implies a subscription model. So are you, is that how the model works?
That's exactly how the model works. So what we do is, so typically these systems are something that you would buy. What we do is we buy and wrap all of this up into a turnkey product, which we call the Taskmate. Which consists of a mobile stand, a robot, our software, a lot of peripherals that are sort of the USB part of it that let you easily integrate different tools and cameras and sensors, et cetera. And we sell that all for a low monthly rate, which means that for a lot of manufacturers, especially smaller manufacturers who might have fairly hard constraints on their capital equipment sort of purchasing ability, but have a lot of operating equipment budget, right? And so, or operations budget, right? So because we're now a service, they can treat us as an operating expense, which makes it a significantly lower barrier to purchase our software or our system rather. I mean, honestly, a lot of these companies just look at it as an employee, right? You know, if you break down the numbers, our robot, if you work at one shift, costs the same as a fully burdened line operator for most of these companies. If you work at three shifts, it's like, you know, a quarter of that, right? So it ends up being extremely cost effective for these factories. And it's a business model that they're used to. They're used to paying for this because they're used to paying employees. They're used to having an operating budget where they have monthly reoccurring expenses. So it just makes everything much more streamlined for these companies.
Yeah, makes sense. So, okay, let's get into fundraising capital, because it sounds like given that model, you need to raise a decent amount of money if you're purchasing the equipment, then leasing it out or sell, you know, renting it as a service, so to speak, over time.
Yep.
How much have you guys raised so far and how many rounds?
So our first seed round, we initially raised $1.75 million. That was in April of 2016. We ended up raising a follow-on round of another $2 million as sort of a seed two later in the fall. And then this past December, we raised a $15 million Series A. That first seed round was and the follow-on was led by RRE out of New York, and the Series A was led by Drive Capital here in Columbus, Ohio.
Well, let's go into each of those. So when you were raising the seed, you had spun it out of Johns Hopkins Carnegie Mellon or
no, it was Johns Hopkins.
Johns Hopkins, and did you have a product already, or was it more conceptual of this?
It was more conceptual at that point. We had a sort of a research prototype, and what we ended up spending that initial $1.75 million on was building that out into a production prototype that we could then go around to factories and really learn with. Because I had been working with a lot of customers sort of leading up to our exit from Hopkins, just because I wanted to get as much information as I could. But what that original seed money really allowed us to do is build, I think we built 7 prototype systems and deployed them to customers on basically alpha tests, where we would go into a customer, we would try and solve a manufacturing problem, we would see how well it worked, we would take that lesson and that knowledge and refine the product further. And we basically, and then our investors were very impressed with our, you know, how rapidly we had progressed. They gave us the additional $2 million later on that fall, which let us just do more of that. And then ultimately, at the end of, or I'm sorry, mid-2017, we built out our first actual production version, which we're still selling right now.
Gotcha. And with that in hand and some sales to boot, that's what you used to raise the $15 million Series
A? That's exactly right. Yeah.
What, that's interesting. I guess, how do you, you know, robotics is such a different industry from antiperspirant hand lotion. How are you forecasting that you need $15 million? Like, how do you kind of come up with that number? Is it a function of what the robots cost, your sales pipeline, you know, some lifetime value of the customers who are renting this? I keep saying rent. I know that's not the right word, but basically subscribing to this as a service. Like, how are you kind of come up, you know, with that amount?
So we were initially looking at raising 10, and the round was oversubscribed up to 15. So we got really lucky there, which was amazing. But that original budget was really about scaling the business, because we had sales, we were shown that the product was fitting. And we had some really exciting sort of future technical thrusts that Drive was really excited about as well. So that's sort of the why that came to be. The budget, though, was really about growth from the standpoint of a hardware company, because even though we are spending a good amount of effort on building out our software so that we can make these things easier to program, and also expanding that software out onto different robot systems, right? We want to be as agnostic as we can be. Like you said, these are off-the-shelf products, right? And if you want to create the standard, you have to be able to operate on lots of different platforms, right? That aside, we are building hardware right now, and that because we're building this sort of turnkey system, which really lets us enter the market easily, right? The robotic software market is a hard market to enter by itself, in my opinion, because you sort of have to convince other people to run your software on their hardware, and you have to sort of have that extra step of getting to your value proposition, this extra logistical step. Well, with one of our systems, we can just send it to you in a crate and you unpack it and it works, right? Or we can roll it off the back of a truck and you wheel it up to your machine, and in an afternoon, you're making parts, right? It's turnkey. It's turnkey from the software standpoint, and it's turnkey from the hardware standpoint. And you kind of need both of those to get your product in and let your customers start using it immediately. Which means that we need a decent amount of capital to actually fund the hardware aspect and the hardware development growth as well, and in the production. So we now have we originally had a 7,000 square foot facility in Baltimore. We now have a 50,000 square foot facility in Columbus, where, you know, which 2/3 of which is production, and the where we're actually making these things, and the other 1/3 is R&D and office space and et cetera. So that's really, so that type of growth where, you know, we were very excited to expand software to different robots, to grow as a platform as well as a product. And that's the sort of two things that you have to balance, is you want to grow the product, you want to make this thing that people will buy. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you want to grow the platform where you have this piece of software that runs on lots of different hardware. And those, you know, those both end up costing a decent amount of money from a budgetary standpoint. The other thing is The talent that I'm recruiting is also slightly more expensive than a normal software company would need, because I'm hiring people with PhDs in robotics. So, so there's that thought to it as well. So that's why the number is a little bit larger than, let's say, as a software as a service company, making an app or something, where their Series A might, or their growth sort of financing might be less at this stage.
Yeah, really interesting. What so Drive led the round. How many investors did you talk to, and talk about raising that round? How did you kind of go about it? You had your production prototype in hand. You had some sales. If you're willing to share, that'd be interesting, but you know, that's optional. How'd you kind of put together your investor list and funnel?
Yeah, so we reach out to a lot of, and a lot of investors were very interested in what we were doing, because the space of robotics companies, is there's not that many of them as compared to like an app company, right? Mm-hmm. So it's already sort of a boutique market from that standpoint. So we already had existing relationships with people who we wanted to reach out to, and who reached out to us for the reason that they're, you know, getting into robotics, and that's becoming a much hotter investment market than it was, say, 2 years ago. It's much easier to find financing now. I think it's been, I don't know if it's actually been de-risked as an investment sort of tranche, but it's definitely looks like it's been de-risked. Okay. And so, so I think that it's better now, but when we were raising, we had to talk to a lot of investors, because there are a lot of investors who were concerned about working with hardware companies, because that's just an extra, especially if it's they're out of their wheelhouse, right? Yeah. They just don't understand the concerns of hardware. And so, which is great, right? And that's, I wanted to work with somebody who really understood our business and understood our value proposition, and understood that as a robotics company doing hardware, you can't survive on ramen noodles. You kind of have to have the money to build the stuff that makes it work. There's only so many corners you can cut in terms of the capital that you need, right? So we had to find an investor who sort of was attuned to the hardware side of the investment. We also wanted to find investors who understood the business model, who understood that robots as a service, which has the potential to be as lucrative a sort of paradigm shift in the industrial robot market as SaaS was for the software market. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, also sort of fits better in I think what most investors are looking for in a company, which is reoccurring revenue rather than just, you know, we make money. Mm-hmm. But we really had to find investors who were really attuned to the fact that there's a huge potential for value creation with a service-based company. But a hardware service-based company, you have a lot of upfront costs. You have that, you have all of those robots you have to keep on the books. You have a large balance sheet that you have to maintain. Fortunately, we found an investor who is, you know, certainly much smarter than I am on the finance side, who can think creatively about how to leverage the debt that you create by creating that that balance sheet. Mm. But it took a while to find sort of an investor who was a really good fit from that standpoint.
What do you do? Let me pause you there for a second. Like, how do you find that investor? Because there isn't a category of investors called robot as a service, right? So do you look at, again, hardware investors? Do you look at SaaS investors who might have a hard, do you look at some other metaphor, like investors who've done vehicle leasing or some other, you know, some right, other kind exactly. of analogy? Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, that's exactly right. And we looked at investors, for instance, like we looked at some of the investors who invested in Tesla, who invested in SpaceX, SolarCity, other very capital intensive, but also in the long term, extremely lucrative business models, right? We looked at a lot of them. Drive Capital actually ended up reaching out to us, which was very exciting. And because they were specifically looking for a company in the robotics space who was interested in that service-based model because of how potentially lucrative it can be. But it sort of took time to find that fit, and we got very lucky in that Drive reached out to us and was very interested in exactly what we were doing. In terms of getting there, I think my advice would be to don't keep, like, if you've found a really good idea for a business model that you really have think that is something that's groundbreaking and is based on real data, right? It's based on the fact that we know SaaS is a thing. It's a model that we understand, and sure, it's not a huge leap to go to. And U-Haul is a model that we understand, right? Which is a vehicles as a service business, right? So it's an expensive physical object as a service business, right? So we understand that that can be a thing and that it can be lucrative, right? So it was just finding, putting that out there as sort of our mission. And, you know, on our website, in our media, when we went to trade shows, that's what we talked about. And they ended up going to our website, right? So it's really just, you don't want to be cagey about the what you're trying to do. You mm-hmm. want to, and you don't want to try and craft what, if you think you have got it, you don't want to craft a message that is contrary to that because you think that it's more investable or less investable, right? You should be true to yourself. Right. And what you think that your company can do and the way that it can make money. And you will find somebody that believes in that and understands that. But you have to be grounded by data. You can't just make something up. You have to know that the market that you're in or the business model that you have is something that, you know, has been done before in a different form or is something that's emerging as a new thing that is very exciting, et cetera. So you have to have the data to back it up.
And in your scenario, that was, you had some customer sales, so you kind of had a sense of what they're willing to pay. You had some, yep, obviously, sense of what the robots cost, so you could kind of forecast out what the business model looks like. Like, when you say grounded in data, what did it kind of look like for you guys when you were raising?
So we had reached out to, we didn't have very many systems at the time that we were raising to actually sell because we were ramping up production, but we had reached out to a lot of customers and knew that there was an appetite for this service-based model because for the reasons that I already mentioned, right? People don't want to get tied up in capital equipment. It's very difficult for them. The sales cycles are extremely long. For smaller companies, they hate doing it. And for larger companies, they love doing it, but it takes forever, right? It might be a 6 to 9 month process to actually get set up to even be a vendor before they'll think about buying something from you, right? So, it really comes down to understanding that, you know, or for us, it came down to understanding that our customers like wanted this business model and were interested in thinking about it from the operations standpoint. So those were a lot of data points that we had from real customers saying, yes, I would do this if you sold it to me that way.
That's super helpful. I think that's a key thing. Was it kind of like a sales pipeline that you could walk into the investor and say, look, these guys haven't written us a check, but they're basically on on board if we, you know, can deliver, we need the capital to deliver, kind of that sort of model or pitch?
It wasn't quite as turnkey as that, but we definitely knew, and we had, at the time, we were actually, we were sort of doing a mixed model where we were also selling things. And we were very straight that, like, there were several sales that we didn't get because we, at the time, weren't financially able to do them as a service to front the cash for the system. Yeah. But and a customer would have bought that. They would have been like, oh my God, it's X number of dollars a month. This is amazing. Let's do it. And we just weren't financially in a position because we were at the end of our sort of seed round burn. Yeah. You know, we didn't have the cash to do it. So we had been saying no to customers. So we knew that the demand was there.
I think, but that's a good general tip is if you know, if you've got the customer sales and you can put it on a slide, that's great. If not, you have to demonstrate demand in mm-hmm. any way you can, you know, to go to investors. How many investors would you say you talked to at the seed round, and how many did you talk to at the Series A? What does it take?
I would say, so there's a couple of things that I think are good sort of lessons learned from this. The first one is relative to time. I would say that you should start raising 6 months earlier than you think you should. I would say, like, if you're a seed company and you're looking at an 18-month burn for your seed money, you should start reaching out to investors by month six into that 18 months. You should start having serious conversations by month 12. And I mean very serious, because by the time, if you get somebody who's really excited, if you get the one who will end up being your investor at month 12, they probably still have like 3 to 6 months of diligence in terms of, especially from the seed standpoint of looking at where you are right now. If you don't have a lot of sales, they're going to sort of wait and see how your sales progress. You might have to have a couple of touch points with them to really see, like, hey, is this a ramp, right? Are you actually going up? Is this going somewhere? So I think timing is really important. Reaching out early, building the relationships very early, even though you might not be making an ask, right? You're not making an ask of an investor 6 months in, but you're getting to know them. You're getting to see what's in their portfolio. You're beginning to understand how they invest their money and what they're interested in, right? And then 6 months later, when you're, you know, sort of seeing the end of the, you're seeing the edge of the cliff, you're already very deep in a conversation with them. You've already sort of pruned away the guys that you know are not going to be a good fit. Not necessarily because they don't think that you're a worthwhile investment. It might just not be what they do, right?
Yeah.
We got a lot of no's because we were hardware. They were like, you guys are doing amazing stuff. I can't wait to see what you guys do, but we do not invest in hardware companies, period, right? That's it. We also got a lot of investors who said no because I think there's a lot of investors who really want you to move out to the valley, or rather there's a lot of investors who want to be very close to you. Mm-hmm. I think it's sort of the way one investor explained it to me is basically like risk versus distance. Okay. If you're very de-risked, if you're a very well-known business model, if you're creating an app as a service, right, and we understand what you're doing, you can be across the country. You don't need to relocate your company from Baltimore to Silicon Valley because we get what you're doing. Right. We don't get what you're doing. We still think you're cool. We're still going to invest, but we don't get what you're doing. You're going to need to be closer because we want to be more hands-on. Right. Yeah. Well, in our case, because we're working in the manufacturing space, right, the big hubs of manufacturing are the Eastern Seaboard, the Midwest, and Texas, right? California is not one of them, unfortunately, mm-hmm. right? So in order to be close to our customers, we definitely had to, you know, say no to a few investors or rather have, you know, sort of finish up earlier with investors that just because they wanted to be closer, right? And they were out in the valley or they were somewhere else and we wanted to be close to our customers. So it's that dynamic as well. And there's always cases where that will work for a certain company, right? But for us, we knew that we needed to be close to our customers. And so we maybe had to part ways with several investors or maybe we had several investors who were just non-starters because of that. So that's something else to think about.
I like the risk versus distance framework. That's a good point. I never heard it framed quite like that, but it totally makes sense. Okay, this is interesting. Did you you talked about the timing of fundraising. You really got to start talking to these guys 6 months out of an 18-month runway and serious conversations at month 12. Did you guys do that, or is that sort of a lesson learned for next time?
That was definitely a lesson learned. Uh-huh. We started seriously fundraising with about 9 months of runway.
Yeah.
And it was close. Uh-huh. Right. By the time we started actually engaging investors to the time we closed in a meaningful way, it was 6 months, which is what everybody tells you. Everybody tells you it takes 6 months to do the raise, right? Mm-hmm. But what they don't tell you is those initial conversations before you're sort of at the point where they're in and then you start the 6 month clock potentially takes, you know, longer.
Yeah.
So you have to start building these relationships as early as you feel comfortable, right? Even if you don't have a product yet, even if you don't have any market traction at all, go out to, you know, meetups, go meet with investors, go introduce yourself, go participate in that community and talk about what you do and talk about what your vision is. And then as you have more and more conversations, meanwhile, your business hopefully is growing, you're getting sales, you're starting to develop product market fit to the point where you get to the third or fourth time that an investor has met with you and you're already best buds. They already understand your entire business model. You probably pivoted twice, right?
Yeah.
So they have the whole picture. So you as a company are not much of a risk anymore because they already know everything. They don't have to do 6 months of due diligence to find out what you're doing because you've already told them everything over the course of, you know, the burn of your first investment, right? Yeah. So creating those relationships early on is something that we waited to do. And I think, you know, we ended up fine, but I think that I recommend any other startup to definitely start those conversations early.
I might've missed it, but do you have a feel for how many investors we have the timeline? Do you have a sense?
Yeah. Okay. So we probably spoke with roughly 20 investment firms for our series seed.
Mm-hmm.
We got deep in diligence with about 5. And I also have to say that the reason that might be less than a lot of startups, I also have no touch point for it. But if that doesn't sound like a lot, what I would blame that on is we had a very robust network of investors who were prowling around Hopkins looking for investments. Mm. So Johns Hopkins really helped us there. You know, I had the investor, the partner that we worked with, or one of the partners that we worked with RRE is Stuart Ellman. He had visited and saw my research prototype like 2 years before we actually started fundraising. So we already had existing relationships with a lot of these guys because of the great job that Hopkins does at sort of cultivating those relationships. But fortunately, most you know, serious research institutions do that same job. Their tech transfer groups do that, and the sort of alumni associations do that same good job of sort of potentially funneling research or investment towards startups that are emerging from their university. So that's a thing, which is great. Yeah. So I feel like that made it a little easier because we were sort of a known quantity for a lot of those investors. I would say that we reached out to about 60 investors for Series A, and we got into deep due diligence with about less than 10, probably like 7 or 8 of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, so part of that is a numbers game, but I would say it's about most of those conversations were just sort of no's just because of the difference in what they invested in, right? And so those were valuable conversations because it sort of led us in a lot of cases towards investors that who were more likely to invest. You go to a person and you say, hey, we actually, you know, our portfolio, we by on principle don't do any hardware stuff, but, you know, X company down the street does, go talk to them. Here's the person, you know. So again, if you've already built up these relationships, then your Rolodex and people's willingness to sort of pass you on to other investors who also might be interested is broader. Mm. And so you can sort of start the top of the funnel bigger than you would have otherwise.
Good stuff. All right, I won't keep you much longer. You've got 50,000 square feet of facilities to manage.
Yeah,
it sounds really cool. Again, I'm picturing this just amazing, like, you know, robotic wonderland of interesting things going on, R&D labs and stuff. One more question, and then we'll wrap it up. But, you know, any other advice you would either give your younger self doing this all over again or other kind of robotic related startups who are interested in getting off the ground and raising money? Anything we haven't covered?
I think this is something that is always very important about startups in general is to be focused. I think especially now there are definitely the startups that decide to go into creating a startup because they have a very specific idea and a very specific market. And they're like, we need to do this in this market and we're going to kill it. Right. There's those. Okay. Mm-hmm. In the sort of deeper technology plays, there's a lot of different directions that things can go. Okay. And so when we looked at, our software, like Inc. Magazine called us the Swiss Army knife of robots. Okay. Well, that's awesome because I got a cool quote from Inc. Magazine, but it's terrible in terms of the fact that if a startup is actually that, where you are this multi-tool and you do everything, then you will not succeed at doing anything. Mm-hmm. Right. And so even though we, as part of our persona, talk about this very broadly applicable system that can work on lots of different robots and do lots of different stuff, what we actually sell right now is extremely focused. Mm. And I think that's really important because without that, you don't have a lot of people. You're not some big company who can go in a lot of different directions simultaneously. Yeah. And the cost of failure at this stage is super high, right? So it's really about finding that's what we really did early on with the seed money. That's what I would suggest if your investors are amiable to it. And if they aren't, then you probably should find different investors, because especially in the technology space, exploration to find product market fit is key. Mm-hmm. And that's what you see a lot of robotics companies do. They sort of flounder around for the first year or so that they're in the market, and then they gravitate towards something very specific, and then they sell the hell out of it. And that's really what you have to do, because if you don't have that focus, you won't be able to deliver. You'll be too busy sort of managing all of the different things and managing all of the different directions that you're trying to go, rather than the one that actually can make you money. So the first challenge is finding the one that makes you money quickly, right? But even if it takes you a while to find the one, the sort of narrow path that really makes you money, that is better than finding that later is better on than not finding it and just running through all your money because you could never settle on one product, right? And this is especially important if you're a technology play that ends up being more like a platform. And I know that's like a thing now. It's like everybody wants to be a platform rather than a product, right? Which is great because that's, platforms have a huge, potential to change the world. But what it also means is, it's easy for a platform to expand into this huge amorphous thing that no one will buy because it doesn't actually solve any specific problem, right? Yeah. So it's sort of the Android versus the application thing that Google went through when they were building Android is we have to sell this thing with a camera application that has to work, but we also want an app store and all this other stuff. So it's really about finding the focus in the product that the customer will actually pay for. And then once you get that follow-on money, then you can start to get really creative about like expanding your platform and being, being Microsoft, right? You have to get people to sign on the dotted line on something very specific that solves their specific problem first.
Do you have in your pitch, do you have any little tagline or headline on a slide? We want to be the blank for robotics, like the
Microsoft. We want to be Microsoft for robotics.
Okay.
That's the goal.
That's the
goal. Because if you look at the market and you look at the computer market 40 years ago, there was a massive consolidation from customized boutique systems to multi-purpose simple systems with common architectures. Mm-hmm. And that's the world that we're in now with robotics. And there will be companies that will look like Apple and Microsoft and IBM did 30 years ago, consolidating the computer market, and we're trying to be one of them.
I like it. Okay. So for Aaron who wants to learn more, it's ready-robotics.com, correct?
Yep.
And do you have anything you, any call to action or plug or anything, buy one robot, get one free,
Hey, if there's a manufacturer out there listening, we make this very easy. We make it stupid easy compared to the competition. And a lot of the price point that we can do because we're doing this as a service makes it a no-brainer. So that's what I would say to them. If there's any, software engineers who have hardware experience. We're always looking for that specific cross section of people for hiring, somebody who's built software that actually works on a physical product, just besides a computer or a phone. That's what the talent that we're always looking for. So
cool stuff. All right, awesome. Kel, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good luck. And it's pretty exciting stuff, I'm sure. Is there going to be a home consumer version where I can like fold my laundry or something, you know, some automated process?
One day. That's
one day. Goal. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Awesome, sir. Best of luck to you.
And thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Take care.